Hello, everyone. Today we're joined by Lotta Moberg, who received a doctorate in economics from George Mason University and the author of The Political Economy of Special Economic Zones. Lotta, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Of course, of course. So normally on this podcast, we're all very optimistic about special economic zones. We look on the brighter side. However, your book takes a realist approach of special economic zones. Can you tell me what are some of the downsides of SEZs you've seen around the world?
Sure. We can start it, thinking about it in two ways, really. SECs, they come in very different forms. So just to give a really broad overview here, they can be of different sizes. They can be developed by the government. They can be developed by private companies. And those are the dimensions, so to speak, that I would divide them in to think about the really, really big zones and the benefits and costs of those versus the really, really small ones. And when I say small, I mean really small. It can be one one floor in one building. And one problem that you can have with special economic zones, because governments are always very much involved, often for good reasons, they want to see development and things like that, they need some level of planning. And really, anyone who's familiar with any arguments about the problem with central planning in the economy generally, you can actually apply a lot of those intuitions and understanding of the problems there on special economic zones. Special economic zones will have companies, a lot of activities. They're going to have to be located somewhere. So you have to make all these choices. And where should you have a zone? What should be produced there? How much and what kind of infrastructure and facilities should you provide? And often the government is very much involved and often allows to get it wrong because they're not really in tune with the business potential in a certain area. So that's certainly one problem. That is, it's a kind of information problem that you don't really know how to improve on the economy. Another really different aspect of the problems of special economic zones is we can assume that the government actually wants to do everything well here, but alas, that is often not the case. People in government find themselves in a position that they have a lot of power when they give these benefits of special economic zones. So hopefully your listeners are a little bit oriented in what these are. Generally, the government will be giving benefits to investors in terms of tax and tariff exemptions. And there are a lot of opportunities here for what we call rent seeking, right? Like a company wants to come into this zone, that gives an opportunity for the government to extract something in return. So you get this exchange, which is really what we talk about rent seeking. And here's where the size comes in, if you indulge me for one more minute. The smaller the zones are, the easier this rent seeking is. And this is why the smaller you get to the size of, say, one company, you really cannot tell anymore whether this is a special economic zone or just a way for the government to give a particular privilege to one company in return. And in return, this company, you know, can give something back, or it's maybe it's just a company that is the nephew of any whatever policymakers is making that call. So those, like the information part of it, the rent-seeking part of it, that's two groups of kind of problems, and there's a lot of things to be said for both of them.
Interesting. So you say that there's a lot of incentives for rent-seeking. What are some policies that can be put in place to reduce the amount of rent-seeking associated with SEZs?
Well, I like to think of it really in the terms of the institutional context here. The problem, and as you say, after reading my book, the special economic zones are not always a good solution, right? Sometimes it's just not what a country should be doing. So one question is really, when are special economic zones actually a good idea, or when do they actually work? One issue is how much centralization really there is in the system. That is, One aspect of this is the fiscal side. So if you have a decentralized system fiscally, so that local policymakers are actually benefiting from fiscal revenue and hence therefore for the growth in the local economy, you have more incentive to actually pursue a zone that is actually economically beneficial. So that's one way of thinking about it. If you want a zone, make sure that you have some fiscal decentralization, but also political decentralization. That is, do the local policymakers who are overseeing these zones, do they have the ability to change the policies, both for the zones themselves and the policies around them? Because the closer you get to the market that you're looking at as a policymaker, the more likely you are to actually see what the problems are and be able to figure out how zones can actually be made to work. Generally, I find that just democratically systems, any checks and balances where it just gives local policymakers also the incentive to actually promote economic growth rather than looking at these kind of policies as a way to just benefit themselves personally.
So in terms of political decentralization, one of the things you mentioned in your speech was that SEZs can actually lead to a cause of a new political equilibrium. Do you think SEZs can actually cause the political decentralization necessary for, you know, SEZ success that you mentioned?
Yes, and this is the most exciting cases. I'm certainly looking for more of them, but I think that the story of China is one where I think that you really have seen this. You have a system of rent seeking. You have quite a high degree of centralization in the system, and somehow you get a zone started. And this is not, of course, going to come from the top, from the people who are overseeing this rent-seeking based kind of system, but rather from people who can benefit themselves from economic growth in certain areas. So this can be a businessman, this could be a local policymakers if you have some decentralization already in place, but it can just be business people. And when you get these zones, the harder it is in the long run, they kind of shift the equilibrium. They can actually shift the equilibrium in terms of it makes it harder for other local policymakers who are rent seeking to actually rent seek, because you get more of the competition in the economy. You can have companies moving from one part of the country into the zones and so on. And you also get a more of opportunity to actually attract investors that you could not have had before. So that's how you get the incentive for more policymakers to see the first zone. Local policymakers in another part of the country may then look over there and say, hey, I can also benefit from this actually more than having a closed and kind of rent-seeking based system. I can try to open up and have economic growth and benefit in that way. And when you get that kind of ball rolling, and if more and more people and in eventually a majority of the ruling elite, so to speak, are favoring an open system, they will also favor the kind of policies that will benefit the zones. They would now want to make this openness actually work. And you could question whether they will know that such as things like decentralization will actually benefit from it, but at least they can access that information and want to pursue it and want to incentivize this growth. And this is really the system you've had in China since the 1980s when they had these zones, that the top echelons of the Communist Party will reward the local policymakers for economic growth. So they want to incentivize them to pursue economic growth, and as we've seen too, they've been allowed to institute a lot of these, hundreds of them throughout China.
Does this sort of counter the very common criticism that market liberals have about SEZs, namely that SEZs prevent from a large-scale nationwide reform and instead keep them localized?
I think that's a very fair criticism, though. I think it's not an argument against that, and I'm sympathetic to that view, but it's going to depend on the initial institutional context. In this way, that if you have a government that comes out, you see there's a lot, the government wants to promote economic growth, and therefore you've had economic growth in XYZ countries, and they have had special economic zones, and therefore we're going to have special economic zones to promote growth. That's a warning flag for me, because you can question whether, if you really want growth and you're realizing that the special economic zones are going to benefit certain parts of your country by having lower taxes, lower tariffs, maybe exemptions from regulations, which they often come from, then why would you not do that more generally across the board? So I think that's a fair criticism. I think the strength of political, of special economic zones, is when they actually are initiated from the bottom, because that's when they actually go against some kind of destructive equilibrium that is maintained by the leaders on the top.
So are you suggesting that perhaps we need to create a grassroots movement for SEZs?
Perhaps, yeah, yeah. I think anything that is politically driven may misfire, in terms of if we do it, and if we would, you know, you and me go out there and to the barricades, right? You know, and wave our SEC flags. We may not, you know, propose the right SECs. You really want people who have a strong incentive to benefit from it from themselves. That is, the business people on the ground who wants to pursue the trade, who have the business contact and so on, to do it. But you can certainly see, you know, organizations that have the political connections partnering with the people who have the business incentive and connections, and make it work that way. Certainly, I think that the smaller organizations, the bottom up, are gonna be the ones that create the special economic zones that will be most sustainable for the future, and the ones that can really benefit an economy as a whole.
I totally agree, and it seems that one of the biggest problems facing SEZs is just the problem of the local stakeholders, specifically citizens. I mean, in Honduras, that seems to be the reason why the project is taking a little bit longer than expected. What are some ways we can frame the startup society movement in a way that can be attractive to citizens?
So from the experience of special economic zones, when we're thinking about startup societies, I think there are many misconceptions in terms of them in any way being predatory to the local economy. So there's a lot of education going on there, and then realizing that they will be beneficial for the economy, because, you know, they're creating jobs, they generally raise wages, they open up just new economic frontiers, so to speak, for the economy. You want to somehow make sure that that is being felt as immediate as for the local people. I think one way to think about this is sure that people from the start are somehow perhaps shareholders, and really explicitly shareholders. So I've been inspired just by hearing what it's like to live in Alaska and getting a check from the government, right? From the state for the oil exploration. And it's like, people love it, right? Because it's like, okay, we have a stake in this. We don't have an incentive to vote against, because otherwise you'll have some environmental movement there, right? That would continuously make people vote against oil exploration in Alaska, which would be devastating. I think that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is, of course, to just think about, well, people are going to get opportunities here, employment opportunities, education opportunities. That should be clear from the onset. And it's really, like, it really shouldn't be a hard sell if you look at the facts. But they can be, I mean, there's mostly a lot of cultural and emotional things. We don't want some special jurisdiction here and so on. So I think it's a lot of communication, education, and then once it gets going off the ground, to really show that, hey, this is really in your own interest and at your service.
I really love the idea of shares because of, you know, if the value of the startup society goes up, then, you know, their shares go up. So they have incentive to maintain it and support it. Do you think we could possibly use that to incentivize entrepreneurs to build infrastructure in these zones? Because of, you know, infrastructure builders, they would gain the most out of building their infrastructure because of it would drastically increase the value of the land.
Sure. I mean, you can think of many setups, and it's going to be some kind of rough edge kind of maths to figure out what should be the weights and shares and things like that. But I mean, one way that the private classical special economic zones work, if you think about a special economic zone in terms of in the form of just an industrial park, which is the very common form. I don't think it's the best form. I think more larger diversified zones are better, where people actually live. But how they usually work is that you have a private developer and they supply the infrastructure. And then they, from the companies that come in and invest there. And if you'd have a bigger zone, you could have a private developer that charge rent from both the companies that invest there and the residents. And so there's already a very simple way in which you have a lot of incentive for investors to supply infrastructure. And they have very much the incentive to supply, like maximize their rents. I mean, cost of to building the thing. And what you get often in these private zones as a good contrast to government zones is more quality services, just quality infrastructure, and smarter, more efficient solutions. And you see supply of healthcare and activities and things like that. I did for my book, I did research in the Dominican Republic and watched this, and it's really impressive, and it's really particularly impressive if you compare that what you'd think that the government would have a lot of incentive to think about welfare, but often they just throw concrete on the problem, so they tend to be more, you know, more things but not as high quality because they don't have to worry as much at being efficient. So a startup society I see very much as the best form you can think of a privately developed zone. And then your question has to do really with, well, can we implement the shareholder part to incentivize this? And if that is needed as an additional incentive, I can certainly see, you know, as a developer, you also get X amount of shares, but it could also be a case where that is not needed in the first place, because there's a clear profit motive, as long as you can extract rents from the people living and investing there.
Do you foresee any potential problems with the developer having a monopoly, or do you think that would be a natural monopoly? You don't see many benefits to having competing firms develop infrastructure in a single startup society?
I don't see a problem with it. It's going to be really a question of size here, because smaller zones, smaller communities, you can, as long as you have more than one, or I mean, you can always move between them if you don't like the services. So that's a competition, voting through your feet kind of competition.
Right.
You can also not invest in the zone. You always have the option of, like, I don't want to go into that zone if it doesn't provide a good option for you. With a bigger one, I do think there should be a benefit from having more competitors, but it doesn't have to be necessarily that you have to have some kind of antitrust bureau to establish this. I think that would come about because no one company might want to be alone in creating, you know, building a full city if it's a big one. Or if it's a flexible structure, I can see it as starting with one company having a first mover advantage, but then others coming in latching on and saying, hey, you know, we want to supply this infrastructure here and then to extract rent, and we want to piggyback out of your starting this. And the first one might not, you know, might be limited in how much they really want to invest. They, you know, any company may want to diversify. If their business model might be to not, you know, to be invested in more startup cities than one, and they don't want to be 100% into one in case something happens there. So I certainly see that as a kind of more of a natural development. If you do have a company, one company wanting to just build everything, that's kind of less likely, but I don't see that as a problem of monopoly. I think they're going to be in a very vulnerable situation rather to make sure, they're going to have to make sure that they're giving a good proposition for both residents and investors there.
This is what I love about this movement. We're at a time when it's so early on, you can ideate about all these different paths you can go forward. So perhaps the best way to end on all this is, what are the most exciting trends you see in the startup society's industry? Ways that SECs can go forward and go above and beyond before?
Oh, I think from my own perspective as a special economic zone scholar, a lot of often it's very government driven, but many governments are looking into zones that are less reliant on these just fiscal benefits, that is tax and tariff exemptions, and really looking at, rather than just cutting costs, really looking at how to open up more opportunities. There's a realization in the world that there's only so much space for another t-shirt, you know, textile manufacturing zone in another country, that the competition there is really tough, and that there's a lot of opportunities for not only developing but also developed countries to really open up for really being the forefront of, say, education, like in Songdo in Korea, and the high tech space in several countries. So that realization that it's about opening up opportunities, I think that also lends itself a lot to the lessons for startup societies in terms of thinking about, how do we get autonomy? How do we get the regulations right? The rules are going to be everything. There are so many opportunities out there for anyone who just wants to minimize their taxes. If you're out for just cutting costs through taxes and tariffs, there are other places you can go. This is should really be a way to rather to open up the opportunities. So I think that's where we can learn a lot, and we do have already some examples from just the classical, especially economic zones. They have a lot of problems, and now there are opportunities to both learn from them, but also to do that better.
Excellent. Lota, thank you so much for coming on. And everyone, please read her book, The Political Economy of Special Economic Zones. Thank you, Lota.
Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you for